Welcome back to the next episode of this series. For today's episode, we get to hear from a chayal himself, from Nissan Augustine, a local Chicagoan who is so willing to share his own experiences and give an insight into what it's like to be a chayal at this time. First and foremost, and mainly what speaks to me about all the chayalim are the incredible videos and power and strength and koach that they have fighting for Am Yisrael, and the resilience that they live through, that they continue to embed upon all of us. And we're so grateful for Nasanel to take some time of his very busy and precious moments to share some insights with us.
Welcome. My name is Yechiel Bressler, assistant director and therapist at Upward Community. You're listening to Mental Health Matters, the podcast where we do a deep dive into the mental health challenges confronting the Orthodox Jewish community. Join us as we identify, explore, and open up the conversation about some of the biggest struggles facing our community today.
Nissanel, thank you so much for taking the time. I know it is very busy, and every moment of your time these days, always, but especially these days, is very precious. So thank you for being willing to join us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So, indeed, of course, once again, thanks for coming up. Those don't realize that we're recording on an early Sunday morning, but this really is Mesiras Nefesh, so we appreciate it as well.
At least it's not during the football season. If it was during the football season, we wouldn't be doing this, but Baruch Hashem, we have a free morning.
Yeah, exactly. Big news, coming off the big news here with a new era in Chicago.
Yes.
But we'll see how that bodes. But anyway, so let's get to it. Nissanel, thank you again. And, you know, just to start out, like, give us, you know, if you don't mind, a little bit of just a background, like what you're up to personally and, you know, professionally in life. And then more specifically, you know, where you stand. I know, you know, you're in the army. I know you served in Gaza. Are you still going back and forth? What are you up to with that?
So in life, I guess I can just go back to, I guess, where I was October 7th when the whole war started. So I work for a company in America, in charge of accounting and finance. So obviously I'm working remotely. My wife and I actually just moved back to Israel in July of 2023. I used to live there. I was in the army when I was in my regular service. I was in Yeshiva and Hesder. And then I got married, so I moved back to America for a year. And then my wife and I moved back to Israel in July. We live in Karmei Gat, a neighborhood in Kiryat Gat.
Pardon my ignorance, but where is that relative to stuff I might know?
So Beit Shemesh is about 25 to 30 minutes away from Beit Shemesh.
Okay.
And then a little farther south, about 25 minutes south of your Sderot. And then another few minutes here in Gaza, if you're able to still drive. So on October 7th, I'm still currently doing this, but I work in finance and accounting, working remotely. So obviously working late nights in Israel on American hours. And then a week before the war, my wife, about a week and a half, 9 days, my wife had her first baby, a baby girl, born on September 28th, 2 days before Sukkot. So I was just adjusting to new life. I also am currently an active reservist in the Israeli military. So that, I guess, involves whenever you get called up, you're training once a year, twice a year. Sometimes you do guard duties in different areas. It's called Tasuka Mifzai. Like active, doing guard duty, like what people do in the Gush, what they do on the border in Lebanon, and then training. And then also you're obviously on call if there anything, God forbid, happens, like a war. It's called a Tav Shmona, an emergency call-up. That's kind of what happened to us on October 7th. I was in Harnof for Shabbos that week, just kind of trying to enjoy Chag. It was our first Chag actually at home, because the first day of Sukkot we actually spent in the hospital. Because it was in 48 hours. And so the second time we were in Harnof by family. And that's when it pretty much all started, on Simchas Torah morning. I was in Shul. And that's kind of when everything changed. Sirens going off left and right. You kind of just like, okay, this has happened sometimes in Israel. You know, it's a normal thing. I mean, I hate to say that it's normal, but, you know, you get used to it after living here for so long. It's just a normal thing. You expect it to happen once in a while. Sometimes in Jerusalem, Yerushalayim, it happens once in a blue moon, but it just kept going and going and going. So it was just kind of like something's going on here. So my first thought was, okay, I'm going to go home and check on my family. So that's exactly what I did. And my second thought is, okay, you know, it's Shabbos, but, like, there's a lot of sirens. I got to make sure my commander didn't text me. So I went to open up my phone, and little did I know, I had a WhatsApp for my commander.
Wow. Saying, we need you.
So the beginning, actually, the first text was, okay, guys, we haven't been called up yet, but just wait. I can get you exactly, if I look on my phone, exactly what time it is. I'm not going to go because it's going to take some time to find it. But I think it was approximately, like, 10 o'clock in the morning. It was right after our kafos. So it was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And as I finished that voice note, he sent another one. And I'm like to my wife, I'm like, oh boy, here it comes. I'm probably going to be leaving.
Yes.
Exactly what it was. They told us, get your gear, come up north to meet everybody, and then we'll give you more information when you get there. So I packed my whatever bags I had. I actually had to drive to Kiryat Gat to get all my stuff. So I had to drive an hour from Yerushalayim, and then I had to drive another few hours up north afterwards. So that was...
Was there like a deadline? Like, you got to be here by this time?
So I think the official rule is you have to be there within 24 hours of getting the official call-up. Most people were there within a few hours. I have friends that actually were on a trip in Thailand, or I think it was Thailand or India somewhere, and they hopped on a plane on Shabbos to get back.
I find I got so many questions, because like just technical type questions here, that it's like, because it's like fascinating to me, the whole concept of being a reservist. So you're saying that you just have like a direct communication with your commander, as opposed to having like, forgive me for being naive and thinking like secret spy movie, like you don't have a separate phone. It's all on the same phone.
Yeah.
He just texts you. He says, go get your gear. And wherever you are, do you have a bag packed up ready to go?
So I initially didn't. I had to go home and pack it myself. I realized after that I should probably always have something ready to pick up if I need to go pick up my bag and, you know, leave. So that, you know, I guess always to be prepared. You always, it's something you think about, because in Israel, the law is you have to do reserve duty until, depending on where you are, 40 or 45, sometimes even later, depending on your job, or if you have six kids. I mean, I have people with me in Milim who have, you know, reserve duty, who have like 9, 10 kids, and they're still coming. So they're volunteering at this point. So just kind of like the, you know, I guess, serious nefesh, the resilience that people have when they do come, like they're leaving their families. And, you know, I left a 9-day-old baby. That was very hard, to be honest. You know, it was like, I mean, who knows how long I'm going to be gone for? Who knows if I'm going to come back? No one has any idea. You know, there's always those things flying through your head in the moment. But you're also just like, okay, this is what I got to do. But it's just kind of like, it's the kind of thing like, I left a 9-day-old, my first baby. These people are leaving 9, 10 kids with their wives alone. So it's just, you know, the kind of, you just see like, it gives you a lot of, I guess, energy, a lot of, you know,
chizuk, koach.
You know, just, okay, I'm not the only one that's, you know, leaving everything, dropping everything behind. I mean, for me, I think I had a little bit also of a different situation, because I work an American job. So there's a rule in Israel that your job can't fire you for going to Miluim. They can't dock you pay. They still have to pay you. Thank God my boss in America is really sweet, really nice, and he still paid me, and I still have my job. They took care of me while I was out. So shout out to him.
You know, talking about the inspiration and the chizuk, one of the most inspiring stories I heard was after people started hearing what was going on, they were lining up to reserve even before their commanders were calling them up. Like, I heard that type of story.
Yeah.
And like, it really is. It's tremendously, it's amazing. And like, hearing you say that, it's not just me. It's seeing that I'm with a bunch of other people that are also all on the same passionate level of what we're doing here.
Yeah. I mean, there were people. I mean, I don't know of anyone personally that went to their commander before they got called up. I mean, my brother also got called up on that day. I know he already started getting ready to go before he even got the official call up. I mean, his commander's like, okay, you guys, we're getting called up. Just get ready. And then eventually, I think a few hours after I got my call up, I think I was already on my way up north, he got his call up. So he was kind of like my rabbi on Shabbos. I'm like, like my brother Avi, like, Avi, what am I supposed to do? He's like, you got to do whatever you need to. Just think about it as like a Tuesday afternoon. Okay?
Wow.
Just do it what you think and just do it, because it's, you know, it's pikuach nefesh. You know, you don't know where you're going to go. They at the beginning, they initially thought we're going to go into Lebanon. That was one of the thoughts.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's why we actually stayed up north for the first 2 weeks, because we didn't know if we were going to go into Lebanon or not. Eventually we moved on south, but that was also a thought, and, you know, we're just like, well, I couldn't really be in touch with my family. I couldn't really tell them where I was.
I was going to backtrack us for a minute, if we can, to that, you know, to that initial call up, like that initial, just, you were describing about the voice notes, and like, first of all, your own emotions, like you said, like on the one hand, like I'm leaving my nine day old baby, and I have my wife, you know, I'm still pretty newly married. I don't know what's going to be. And like, so I can imagine like the whole slew of emotions. And then you have like your family's emotions. I mean, your kid is obviously too little to realize, but your wife, right? And like in that moment, can we like just pause, like, you know, pause that moment for a minute, and just, can you share a little bit like what, in retrospect, kind of what was going through your, whatever you're comfortable sharing, obviously, but like what was going through your head in that moment?
So when I got the initial text message that it says it's not happening yet, but it's going to happen, I'm like my heart dropped a little bit. I'm like, oh, wow. Because like we got bits and pieces of what was going on. So we didn't know if we were going to go down south. We didn't know if we were going to go up north. Like we were getting bits and pieces. And then he gave us the call up and my heart kind of just like dropped. I'm like, okay, like this is real. You know how people say like the Yom Kippur War, people got called out of shul. This is kind of like a similar idea. Obviously, it's not Yom Kippur. It's Simchas Torah. I mean, one of the Chagim. And it's not like you're not expecting. It was actually, I think, almost the 50-year anniversary of the Yom Kippur War. Because like your heart kind of drops. And I remember just going to my wife and like, I have no idea when I'm going to be back. I have zero clue. I love you. And God willing, you know, I'll see you soon. We'll be in touch. And if there's any updates, I'll let you know. At that point, I was just kind of like, I got in my car and, you know, it was just kind of weird, you know, driving through Har Nof on a Shabbos morning. It's like people are looking, it's like, what's going on? I don't think people really started realizing yet what was happening. But it was just kind of like going through my head. I'm like, I don't know what to expect.
That to me screams like for all the chayalim, for your wife, for everyone, you know, in that situation, it's almost sounds like one of the hardest and most difficult things to move forward is this concept of the unknown. Just like, I'm just leaving everything. I'm just dropping everything. And I just don't know. I just don't know what's going to be. I don't know. Like you said, am I going to see my wife and kid again? Am I going to lose my job? Am I going to lose my life? Like, I just don't know.
So I actually texted my boss after Shabbos and I just told him like, what was going on? I got called up. I don't know when I'm going to be back at work. I have no idea. And he's like, don't worry about it. Take care of yourself. Make sure everything's safe. We'll take care of you. So that kind of gave me like a little bit of, okay, I'll still be able to pay my bills.
Right.
Granted, the Army does pay you, but I work in America, so it works a little differently.
Right.
That gave me a little bit of, I guess, lowered the...
Relieved some of that, yeah.
Lowered some of the panic. Obviously, I was still panicking because we had no idea what we were going, what we were doing, where we were going. We spent a few days getting ready, getting our gear together, making sure our guns were zeroed out, putting together our APCs, which we didn't end up using. We ended up going in with Hummers when we went into Gaza, but we didn't end up using the APCs. There's a whole other story. Armored personnel carrier.
Got it.
So we didn't end up using those. We ended up going in by Hummer, which was also kind of fun in a sense. But yeah, I mean, it's just the first 2 weeks, we're kind of just waiting to see what was going on. Some of us have been like, okay, like what's going on? We're not doing anything. Why are we still up here? They're not going in up north. They're not going in down south. Like send us somewhere. And then eventually they gave us the calls like, you guys, you're going down south. So at that point, I still had my car with me up north. My wife didn't have the car. I had to take it with me to get there. Like, I didn't have any other way of getting there at Simchas Torah. So I asked my commander, like, can I go bring the car back to my wife on the way down south? Like, my house is on the way. He's like, yeah, go. So that was nice. I got to go home for a few hours. It was about 2 weeks after the war started.
Did she know you were coming or you just showed up?
I told her I was coming. I think I did get the surprise her one time, I think, for Shabbos. That was a fun one. So I got to go home for a few hours. I got to see everybody. My brother gave me a big hug. And I was just kind of like, okay, like everything's hopefully starting to get back to normal. I mean, obviously not normal, but, you know, people are still trying to live their lives as much as they can with it, obviously with whatever's going on. And that, you know, my wife and kid are still there and they still know who I am. mainly my kid. My wife knew who I was. My kid, I mean, she knew me for a few days.
It's such an amazing story. And like, I'm just kind of wondering, how did a boy that grew up in Chicago end up in this spot where you're like, I'm going to decide to go and live in Israel and defend Israel and be in the, you know, like it's like counterintuitive to what the, let's say the American dream sort of is. So I kind of want to know where that passion comes from for you.
So I think number one, it starts with my parents. They're always very like, okay, like Israel, it's, you know, that's our home. Eretz Yisrael, you know, that's where we want, that's our end goal, where we want to be. I had a few siblings that moved to Israel before me. I had a brother and a sister were in the army before I did it. And I kind of just decided like, you know, this is kind of something I want to do. I think it's important. It's how I can, you know, give back to Am Yisrael. Because I knew for me personally, and I know there's many more people out there, I'm not the kind of guy that can sit in the base medrash. I have a very difficult time sitting. It might be because I have ADHD that's gone undiagnosed.
see our earlier podcast episodes.
Yes.
Yes.
You could ask my teachers and my people who took attendance in high school. I had a lot of trouble with that.
Totally understand.
Not only that, though, but I that to me, I mean, again, like, you know, we spoke about this in previous interviews, but like what's powerful to hear about that is like you've channeled, like, okay, so that was hard for you to sit in school, but you've channeled that passion, strength that you do have just in another direction. Said, hey, I know I'm not going to sit in Kol and be in the base of Medrash, but like here I can serve Am Yisrael. And look at what you're doing, you know, so that's amazing.
Yeah, so that was something I figured I thought I could do. You know, go do something to give back. I think it's important that everyone has their one thing or two things, whatever it is, their thing that they do that's giving back. So this was my thing. Go to the army, you know, give up a year and a half, 2 years of my time, and whatever reserve duty I get afterwards. That's my that's me saying, okay, this is me giving back. This is me protecting Am Yisrael. And then, so at the beginning, like in my regular service, I was in Sanchanim. So we sat at the Gaza border for a few months. So like you kind of like think, okay, maybe one day I'll end up there. Who knows? Maybe I'll end up, you know, fighting there. Maybe I'll end up going back, you know. Obviously, like with time, you know, these things, you know, things start to heat up. But when I was there, it was actually relatively quiet at the beginning of COVID. So there wasn't really much going on. But, you know, this is like, okay, I'm risking my life. This is what I want to do. I mean, this is me giving back. Some people, they send the base matter for me. It was, okay, this is my top key right now. That's what I thought I could do best.
Did this concept of, like, fighting in a war, I mean, I know obviously everyone knows that could happen when you're in the army, but like,
right,
I mean, obviously you could never have imagined this specific, but like, did that concept ever come up? Did it cross your mind?
So when you're training and stuff for the army, it's the one thing you prepare for on a regular basis is, okay, guys, you're getting ready to go to war. Like, you're training to go to war. You're training to protect Eretz Yisrael, Am Yisrael. That's your job when you're in the army. So obviously you spent your year, whatever it is, training to do that. And then also in reserve duty and your yearly, you know, stunts of, you know, refresher courses and refresher training. That's your stint, sorry, of refresher trainings. That's what they're training you to do. Did I think when it was happening, it was a surreal moment. I had no idea. Like, I didn't ever think I was actually going to go to war in my life. I had no idea. It's not something that really crossed your mind. So people have this thing like, I want to go to war. I want to do this. I want to do that. You don't want to go to war because it's not fun. War is it's hell on earth. It's Gehenim on earth. Like, you know, it's just kind of being like, you don't know what could happen. You smell death in the air. It's just not, it's not clean. I don't think it's necessarily a normal thing, but it's something that's necessarily, it's been there since the beginning of time. You know, it's something like this, what happened on October 7th, you know, us as Jews, you know, this used to happen to us on a regular basis, pogroms, the Crusades, Inquisitions. Now something like this, you know, God forbid it happened, but now we actually have the ability to protect ourselves, defend ourselves, and make sure it doesn't happen again. So I think that's the difference between now and when it's happened in the past. We have the mitzvah to go to war, the Melchemes mitzvah.
And it's funny that you say that also, because I read this morning, I was reading an article, not to, change the perception out there, but I do actually sometimes read, not always, anyways. It was this from writer, and she was talking about the difference between American and Israeli, and she was specifically like what you're saying. It's like in America, like we don't even understand the concept of what we need to fight for, what we loved, what we fight for that we love, and what we're willing to die for. As opposed to like you who's saying like, I'm going and I don't know what's going to happen, but I know that this is my responsibility and this is what I'm prepared to do to protect not just my wife and kid, but the nation and the land as a whole. And it's mind blowing.
Yeah. So that's also one thing, you know, like it's one thing that I thought about also going through, because I know there's a lot of people out there being like, what's my job now? What am I supposed to do? You know, because I was actually having a hard time at the beginning because we didn't go in right away. And I was talking to my brother, and I just feel like I'm not doing anything. Like, I'm just sitting here waiting. He's like, number one, with the army, everyone has their job. Where you currently are is where you're supposed to be. That's your tough kid in the moment. And I also kind of brought that, like, you know, people who are overseas, people who aren't in the army, you know, everyone has their job, what they're doing, whether it's advocating, whether it's learning, davening, giving money, making barbecues, just as important. So if anyone who ever wants to throw a barbecue, I'll give you my number. I'm going back in May, so I can give you people to do barbecues for. Free advertisement, right?
Especially if we're bringing Romanian.
Yes, Romanian, right? Is a must. I have a bunch in my freezer I just brought back when I was in Chicago. So that's, you know, everyone has their job. I mean, I spoke in a few places in Chicago. I just like, the one thing you really have to know is everyone has their time and place where they're supposed to be. Obviously, God works things out how they work out, but, you know, things to keep people, you know, keep going is everyone has their place, what they're supposed to be doing. So that's what kept me going throughout the time when I wasn't in Aza. And then eventually we did get the call to go in, and your heart drops again. It's like, this is real. Do I really want to go in? Like, you're like, okay, you want to go in, you're here. But it's also like, the second you cross over that border, you don't know what's going to happen. You can get hit by an RPG and not know where you are. I mean, you won't know where you are. They might not even find you. Like, you don't know if that could be it. You don't even know what happens to you. But you're not really, once you cross over, you're not really thinking about how dangerous the place is. Because you're just focused on your job in the moment. Like, my job right now is protecting Amisho. My job is, you know, my people I'm protecting my family at home. I'm protecting my family all over the world. That's what kind of kept me going.
So within reason and within what you're allowed to share with us, you know, what was your job in Aza? And what, I mean, any stories, anything that pop out, anything that, you know, that are worth sharing?
Well, so our job in Gaza, part of our job was to protect the encampment within Gaza itself. So we were in Khan Yunis. I would say just going to Orlando. It's a better vacation place. So we're in Khan Yunis, which is the southern part of Gaza. So our job was to protect the encampment of where the tanks were. So that meant that we had our area where we protected, but also a part of our area was to make sure that there was no enemy in the vicinity of where the encampment was. There were still a bunch of houses up. So a part of our job was every day we went through tons of houses. I probably went through 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, who knows how many houses we went through. There's a lot of houses in total we walked into. We made sure we cleared them out. If we found stuff, we thought it was a suspicious house, we needed to get rid of it. We brought in engineers who blew up the house for us. So that was, you know, just, I guess, part of what we did a little bit. And then, I mean, part of our job, which we, you know, they changed it a little bit, but it's also to protect the convoys. But we didn't really do that so much. We were more just protecting the encampment itself. So we did that. And that was kind of what we did for the time we were in Khan Yunis. Crazy things happen. You run into people, you run into like Gazans themselves. You see people in the distance, you see movements. So you have to, you know, send a tank to send a tank shell over there, or you shoot there just to make sure, you know, it's clean, because you got to protect yourself. We kind of explained to them, like, it's extremely dangerous to be here right now. We suggest you move down south. It's just not a safe area to be in. Because there's tanks everywhere. There's airstrikes, and it's just not necessarily the safest place to be. So I think they understood that, and so then they ended up going down south to Rafiaf, because they wanted to, you know, they wanted to stay alive. Like, that was important, to try and protect themselves.
Like you said, it's like you read from it, but it's just like hearing it live, like, it's like, whoa, like, this is real, you know?
I mean, the most important thing is, like, that's like a textbook case of an ambush, of, like, a family comes out, and then afterwards a bunch of terrorists come out and, you know, ambush a bunch of soldiers. Like, that's happened. Yeah, that's something that's happened. So you always have to be very, very careful.
So what do you do then to protect yourself?
Protect yourself, you bring over more people. You bring over more people just to have more people there just in case something does happen. And then you go through the house, you clear out the house, and then you go move it. We brought the people over to whoever was supposed to, you know, interrogate them and make sure they didn't have any information. They weren't terrorists, they weren't part of, they didn't have any connection. And then afterwards, they decided what to do. That was above my pay grade.
I mean, it's also kind of amazing. You know, I read a lot of, you know, comments online when I get bored. But like, just the idea, like hearing the whole, like exactly what you're saying. People are like, well, they're waving a white flag, and you're like, well, that's great, but that doesn't mean anything, because that's what the exact tactic they use. When we see that, we're more likely to go into like, oh no, what do we do now? And like, get more fight or flighty. I don't know what the word is for that exactly. But like, you get even more prepared to something's about to happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's something, you know, you gotta be careful. It's just scary being there. And then when something like that happens, obviously, like, it's a story afterwards. Thank God nothing happened and no one got hurt. From, you know, us, the family, no one got hurt, thank God. And, you know, we made sure that they were moved to a safe place. But, you know, that in itself, it's still, you know, it's still part of it is like, okay, it's kind of scary, like, because you know, your heart drops, and it's like, this could have been potentially extremely bad, really bad.
Well, and that's why I'm pointing out that the people that aren't in the situation that you're in, they don't understand.
Yeah.
right? It's like, it's very, what I'm saying, I guess what I'm saying is it's very easy to sit behind a keyboard and have an opinion and be a keyboard warrior as opposed to
actually being in there, you know, and knowing what's going
on. Actually being in there, right? Like when we talk about football, Lahavdil, right? And we say, like, if you slow it down, it's pass interference. Well, yeah, of course, if you slow it down and take everything frame by frame, it's easy to see. But we live in the real world, right? We don't live in frame by frame. We live in what's happening now. And when something like that happens to me, I need to respond. However I feel in the moment, I need to save me and everyone around me.
Yeah, that's your most important job in the time, is to make sure when you go to war, the people who are with you, like your brothers, they're like your family, the people that are with you. That's your immediate family. That's who you have to think about. And that's the first people you're saving. Like I would jump in front of a grenade for my commander, like with the guy standing next to me, you know, that's my brother. It's family. You do anything for family. So you kind of have to put like your family at home to the side a little bit, because otherwise, you not necessarily can't think properly, but you have to think of the task at hand.
Were there any like moments, like you said, jumping in front of a grenade? Like were there any moments where you felt your life was at risk, where you faced, you know, it sounds like you faced a lot of civilians. Like, did you interact with any terrorists? Like, I mean, again, I don't know what you can tell us, but like.
So not like immediate interactions with terrorists, but we did have a few things, you know, a few houses caught, you know, like the people were hiding, I guess, trying to booby trap. I don't know if it was booby trapping houses or not. There was one house that we were right by and we were going into, and then they heard some like sizzling. So they all jumped out of the window and then the whole house went up in flames.
Wow.
So thank God everyone got out of that okay. That was also kind of, because that was like right over there. So it was also kind of like one of the scary moments.
What do you do? What's your go-to method for being able to restabilize, like calm yourself down, like at the end of the day when it's time to go to sleep or when it's time to like to wind down? Like what's some of the tactics that you use?
When I was in Gaza or now?
Yes.
I'll take both.
When I was in Gaza, I just think I was purely just always tired. I was really only sleeping at one point only an hour or two a night.
Is it like pure adrenaline at that point? It's like you're not thinking about anything. You're just like...
Yeah, at one point I did get sick though, and I was out for like 2 days.
And what does that mean, you were out for 2 days?
I was like, I had to sleep for 2 days straight. I was really sick.
Like on the base?
In the encampment, wherever we were, in the house we were in. I had to sleep for 2 days. I was really sick. I was not feeling well. I think I had the flu or COVID. I'm not even sure at this point. But like everyone was getting sick just because it's the kind of thing, like it's not necessarily hygiene, but you're not showering. Washing hands isn't the most of important things there. And you're kind of just trying to survive in a sense and not get shot. I mean, just what kept me going there was I was just really tired. So I was able to sleep at home. What keeps me going to sleep? I mean, it's not that I don't try and think about what was going on, but I try and think about like kind of what's in the present, what's happening now. Obviously, like there's things, you know, I still have to obviously work out from when I was there, because obviously everyone after going through something like that should go talk to somebody, which I'm currently doing. I'm not ashamed of it either. I think it's important.
Is that the culture amongst the Chayalim?
I think there are some. I think they're very much trying to encourage people to go talk to people just because it is important. I think it's your mental health. It's like going to the dentist. You know, you got to make sure that, you know, your mental health is stable also, as long as you want to make sure your teeth are clean. You want to make sure your mind is clean. You want to make sure you're stable. So, you know, part of it is helped. I've gone to talk to somebody. What keeps me going, I mean, my baby, you know, my kid, my wife, you know, the family. That's something that keeps me going. Like, I know I did it for something, you know, bigger than myself.
That's a theme I'm definitely hearing from you, and I think is a theme we see all the time from the different Chayalim, right, of this, like, And to me, it speaks so loud to what gives you all that courage to keep going, to be so proud. It's amazing the pride we see from a long distance, you know, of just being able to draw on that, of saying this is life is so about so much more than me. I'm part of something. I connect to something. I'm here for something, and that seems to give you like this sense of mission and purpose.
It definitely does. Just knowing that there's something at home, there's something, you know, bigger than yourself, there's something you're protecting, Amisha, that definitely gives a purpose. Definitely is like, okay, like I have a reason to be here. And that kind of helps, I guess, a little bit.
I think it helps a lot of it with, like, you know, just talking about resiliency, you know, I think that's a big part of it, is that, you know, it's a selflessness that you're helping others, and that gives you a sense of not only just fulfillment, but the pride and the pride of a job well done, almost, you know, like that's a massive part of being resilient through something like this, you know?
Deja, it reminds me of, first of all, what you were saying earlier, the difference, right, between the mentality of, again, not to diminish any part of the world, any society, us in America, but I think what speaks volumes is this idea that you were saying earlier of, like, what am I fighting for? Is this about me? Am I seeking more and more and more for me? More, you know, more physicalities, more mundane things that are I'm seeking that meaning, right? Versus what Rabbi Russell, when he was on our podcast, spoke about this concept of other-centeredness, right? Of being able to live not only trying to figure out what's good for me, but figure out, like, I'm serving others. What can I do for others, right? And I think we all feel that, whether we're in the army or not, but I think on some capacity, we all feel that when we are doing for others, when we are givers, when we are giving, that gives us that sense to keep going. That gives us that strength and that meaning to thrive and to work towards something, which I think is a very powerful idea that I think we're seeing come out in a, you know, the best of humanity when we see the Chayalim. Nassana, I'm wondering also, is this, like, again, obviously from long distance, we see all these videos, right? The inspiring, the chizik that we get from watching you guys, not only fighting, not knowing what you guys are doing every day, but, you know, whether it's the videos of the, you know, for Kabbalah Shabbos or Am Yisrael Chai or all the different, the concerts or the different, like, amazing things that we are seeing. I mean, is that what's coming out? And cute, like, take us into those moments a little?
Of like things like happen, like with regard to...
Just all these like incredible videos that we're seeing of, like, the Chayalim singing and dancing, and like the pet, like you look at these videos now, again, right? Let's remember, I'm sure that there's also, it's not always so glorious, right? And we are watching videos, and it's like that image, you know, that's always going around with the apple and the bite on one side, and you see the mirror. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but of course we know that this concept of we don't always see everything from videos and social media. We see the good things, right? Yeah. But I know for myself and for so many of us here in America, what's given us chizuk is seeing these images and these videos of soldiers just dancing and singing and dancing and being happy. It doesn't seem like from our perspective that, like, the mood is like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm here. It's like that pride.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can tell you, we had people do barbecues for us. We had, I know in Gaza, we had minyanim. We tried to do whatever we could. I mean, during the week, it was a little bit harder, but on Shabbos, if we were able to, we tried doing a minyan in the morning before we went out to do our mission for the day. I remember the first Friday night I was there, it was interesting. Like, we were all tired. It doesn't feel like Shabbos. And, you know, my mempe, my platoon commander, gets up there and, you know, we're all sitting down and he makes kiddush for us. It was a very interesting Shabbos meal to be in itself. You know, I have like a dried hot dog and a sandwich and some grape juice. I got some American grape juice when I was in there. So, you know, that, you know, one thing. Also, people, they made a point of trying to get us, you know, stuff, you know, food, religious articles, you know, that we needed. You know, they brought tzitzis to us. They brought us Shabbos, you know, whatever they could. They brought us some sort of Shabbos food. Where they made Shabbos food before, and, you know, with what we had, we found some, you know, people brought pots and pans with them from home, and then they had gas balloons and stoves, so, we kind of, like, trying to, you know, make the best we could. When we got out, people, you know, were throwing barbecues for us.
I just need to interject there for a second, like, what just speaks so loud about what you were just saying, like, the little details is, like, I don't know, at least for me, like, I have this image of, you know, you're a chayal, you're in Gaza. It's like, this is what my mind is on. This is my focus. I'm blowing up houses. I'm taking families, waving white flags, all these things. And, like, then also, like, living life there, like, little, like, kiddush, or, like, even, you know, comments about, like, American grape juice or the hot dogs. Like, it's just, it, I don't know, it speaks so loud to me, just this, like, going on with life, even the little things.
Well, you try and do what you can to keep yourself sane. Right. So that, you know, that helped a little bit, keep, you know, okay, this is kind of what we do at home, you know, kiddish, grape juice, hamotzi, you know, the regular, and you train the best you can. That, I guess, just was part of, you know, okay, this is what we do. Obviously, if there wasn't time, you don't do it. But, like, thank God I was able to make time to, you know, either try and daven or put on tefillin. I think there was one time I missed davening the whole time I was there. And it was one Marv minion. I think it's because I just was too tired and I fell asleep and I just forgot about it. But I put on tefillin every day that I was there, that I had to put on tefillin. So I just tried to do the little things just to, you know, to keep it going.
Unreal. Can we shift for a second? You know, you were talking about your wife and kid. You're talking about your fellow soldiers, right, who leave their, you know, 8, 9, 10 kids, whatever it might be. Obviously, this is not you. This is the rest of your family. But I'm sure you know from conversation, what gives them this strength to keep going? You know, I mean, I know, like, I have cousins in Israel also whose husbands are serving, and just like, I'm like, okay, I can't get my kids out to school, and I'm fetching about that. But like, how do these wives and kids keep going?
I personally have no idea. I think the real warriors are the families at home.
Yeah,
because it's not, you know, without them, we wouldn't be able to, you know, be able to protect Am Yisrael on the front. You need the people in the back. You need your families at home supporting you. So you know, they're one of the warriors too. They get just as much credit. My wife is a real warrior. She took care of the baby for 4.5 months while I wasn't really home.
My gosh.
Real warrior. So, you know, a lot goes to that, because without that, how can you send the people out? You know, how can the husbands, the fathers go out and try and, you know, do what they can to protect Am Yisrael?
It's just really, really, I mean, I guess like we were talking about earlier, maybe some of that tapping into like this recognition. A, like you said, just like you're not thinking about it, adrenaline, right? We don't have a choice. We just got to get through this.
Yeah.
But like, maybe like tapping into that meaning, which makes sense to me at least, right? That like we see the passion of those living in Israel. It's like it's the passion just comes through loud and clear. And so you mentioned that you are going back in May.
Yes, for now.
So you have like what they said, like you have 2 months off. That's how it works.
I've had 3 months. I've already had about, what is it? It's March 15th. I've had almost 2 months off at this point since the last time I got out of Gaza. May right now, they say we're going back. Don't know to where, doing what. We'll find out, I guess, as it gets closer. It all depends what's happening here at home, you know, here on the front in Israel.
So that means 4 months on, 4 months off? Is that what the timing is?
Yeah, but I don't think we're going back for more than a month and a half. I'm not sure. I don't know any details, really. I just know the date.
They can't call you up in between? It's like, you know, you're not going back till May.
Oh, I could go back earlier. If something happens, I could be back already tomorrow. I could be back tonight. Who knows?
Uh-huh. But assuming things kind of stay status quo, it's...
Yeah.
So how are you using your time between now and then?
Working, spending time with family, pretty much it, trying to do what I can.
I know we're using up a bunch of your time here, so maybe last one or two thoughts. From here in America, obviously there's a lot of different emotions. We're trying to stay connected, trying to support. Like you mentioned earlier, everyone has their role, learning, davening. But from a perspective of the Chayalim, like really what feels imo anochi b'tzara, what feels, you know, like real support, what you want from us, what can we be doing to give that support?
Obviously, I think I spoke about this to a few people. Keep supporting us in the background politically, advocating. I know there's a lot of things going on, protests in the streets, because I don't think people really understand what's actually going on. I don't think people really knew what happened on October 7th, and I still don't understand how people can think what happened was like, okay, no problem with it. Like, you know, stop trying to defend yourselves. I mean, I really think if people really understood what happened on October 7th, they would be like, I actually probably shouldn't be supporting these people. I mean, they killed, mutilated, whatever, who knows what, I don't even want to speak about it. Burn people alive, like the animals, actual animals. Like, I don't understand, you know, I think a big thing would be advocating and, you know, trying to help people understand what's actually going on. I think a lot of these people that are protesting against it who are protesting against Israel don't actually know what's going on. I don't think they have any idea. I don't think they actually understand the extent of what it is actually like there. I can just personally say we were in many different houses. I think every single one had something to do with some supporting Hamas, jihad. Like it's actually insane. I think it's a culture. And I guess it's a lot of it just to get to advocate and trying to explain, you know, this is what it actually is. There's different people on the ground there. Obviously some people are never going to change. You're always going to have those people that are going to, you know, be like, okay, like, I don't really care what you say. This is what I believe and this is what I'm going to do. And it's kind of what the world's turning to anyways nowadays. But really advocating and, you know, trying to, you know, throw your support for Israel and going out to marches, protesting in favor of Israel, just making sure people understand.
Do the Chayalim take note of that? Do they recognize, do they pay attention to this stuff?
I think more the ones who actually have a connection to Chutz Laaretz, to outside of Israel. I mean, me personally, I mean, my family lives in Chicago. I have family all over the U.S. And I have friends who have family all over the world. And it's, I mean, you see, like, for example, what's happening in South Africa. It just seems like people don't really understand the extent of what it is. It's like you're fighting against West. In a sense, we're fighting to keep Western values. As in, right. What Hamas represents is against what Western values, like people in the United States, what us in Israel, what most Western countries represent. They're totally against, you know, Western values. It's, you kind of think about it, it's like when you go, you know, what happened, you know, after 9/11 in America. I mean, I was really a young kid, but like we were trying to get rid of and obliterate that sense of the only way to live is to kill people. No, that's not what our values are. Our values are life. Our values are, let's, you know, try and everyone, you know, whatever we can live harm, you know, in harmony, to whatever extent that actually means. But trying to really just advocate, like, we have to eradicate terrorism in the world. One thing that I've noticed is, you know, I think out of all the armies in the world, even like Israel, like they're even looking out for the civilians of, you know, of their, so, you know, of their enemies, of like, we want to make sure that, you know, no civilians are hurt more, you know. Like, they drop leaflets, they make sure families are okay, they give them safe places to go, they give them humanitarian corridors to get to safe spots. They warn them before they're going in. You know, like, that's Mesiras Nefesh. Because we value life. We, you know, we want to make sure, you know, everyone who isn't trying to kill us, you know, trying, you know, put them in a safe spot. So, I mean, that's also what hit me. Like, it's also like I was thinking about it when the whole situation was happening. I'm like, well, like, this could potentially put us in a lot of danger because you don't know what's behind there. But we're making sure they're safe. We're making sure they're getting to a safe place so they don't have to experience this.
Listen, this is literally bone chilling, as we'd say. You know, just hearing this like firsthand is really, really, really chizik for me. For, I know anyone who listens to this is going to just be amazed both at you, what you're doing, and all the chayalim, and of course your wife and kid, and give us appreciation for all of that, and also just reminding us, even for those of us, number one, for doing what we can from a long distance, like you mentioned, the advocating, the davening, the learning, all the things that we can do. And then, but on top of that, I think that, you know, hopefully this all passes soon. And I think something, you know, a takeaway that we can take, not just from this podcast, but from watching from a distance, is this concept of like, what are we bringing meaning into our lives? What are we attaching to that's bigger than ourselves to give us that drive and that meaning and that motivation, and being able to, what things internally, like you said, you draw on your family, you draw on your, you know, your Judaism, you draw on your passion for Eretz Yisrael, you know, being able to find the things that are meaning for us to push us forward, to help us maintain that drive and keep going. And I think that and you mentioned this idea of we didn't really, we kind of glossed over it, but just thinking through now, we had this idea that when you got sick and taking the time needing to rest up to keep going, right? That there are bumps in the road, but being able to take care of those needs to be able to move forward. So really, like, just so many takeaways for me and it's hopefully all of our listeners, and it's just really, really incredible. I hope that you get to use these next couple of months in quiet and not call back early, and hopefully everything is peaceful by then. You don't even have to be called back then, but in the meantime, that you enjoy your your routine life and your wife, your kid, and just chazak ve'ematz, as we would say.
Thank you.
I have one last thing. Since we're talking about resilience and some mental health coping skills, so one of the things that I find very helpful after talking through a very difficult situation like this is, as Yechiel will know from me, is jokes. So I'd like to, if we can, I don't think I can let you get out with asking, you know, on a lighter side of things, what's your favorite gun to shoot?
I have an M4 when I'm in the Army. I like it a lot. Uh-huh. But I also carry a pistol. I carry a 6-hour 226. Uh-huh. I happen to like it a lot.
Is the 226?
Yeah.
All right. Cool.
Yeah, it's going back to the small things, like you said, and like Nsanal, you said about keeping our sanity, doing what we need to do, staying in touch with the lighter side of things, because otherwise you will literally, you know, like you said, go insane. So another important lesson of the day. Always count on DJ for
the idea is, even after tough situations. Yeah, I was watching this show, and it talked about, this is why I asked you before, it talks about how everyone has to have their chair. What's their chair? Their chair is the thing that they go to at the end of the day to help decompress with all the difficult situations that they have to deal with. It made me think of the conversation that we're about to have and talking about this as a coping skill of what is the thing that we do at the end of the day to be able to decompress and come back to what's important in life, especially when we're around family.
Nsanal, again, chazak ve'ematz, really, really appreciate you.
Thank you so much. Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Mental Health Matters. Keep an eye out for the next episode as we continue the conversation about the mental health topics that you need to know. Don't forget to subscribe so you can make sure you catch every episode. See you next time.